Alternative financial services, better known as payday lenders and check cashers, are both popular with consumers and a frequent target of journalists and comedians.
It's the circle of debt, and it screws us all.
But those paycheck advances can carry high interest rates that may hurt more than they help.
To learn how these businesses operate, Lisa Servan took a break from teaching at the University of Pennsylvania to work as a teller in the South Bronx and in Oakland, California. I spoke with her about the unbanking of America, how the new middle class survives, Servan's firsthand account of what may be the most widely misunderstood industry in America.
So the first thing that really struck me in the book is that there are more payday lenders and check cashers in the United States than McDonald's and Starbucks combined. Is that true?
Yes.
That sounds
crazy. And it's actually just payday lenders. Not even counting the check cashers. And that's an important difference because in 13 states, payday lending is illegal.
So that speaks to some incredible need for this, what you call alternative banking services.
Exactly. And particularly in the case of payday lenders, for short-term credit, small amounts of money for a small amount of time.
What gave you the idea to sort of take a break from your Ivy League job and work in, of all places, in the South Bronx?
I was interested in why so many people were using alternative financial services, payday lenders, check cashers, pawn shops, when the story about them that you hear in the press and even from consumer advocates and from policymakers is that they're predatory, they're taking advantage of poor people. And yet, in the early 90s, you started to see an upward trajectory of use, these businesses growing an incredible amount. So payday lending grew from a $10 billion business to a $30 billion business in about 10 years in the early 2000s. And the kind of the implicit message in all of that writing was that low-income people who were presumed to be the primary users, I found out that wasn't exactly true either, were somehow making bad decisions, that they weren't informed enough. And if only they had the information that, you know, wealthier, upper-middle-class people had, then they would choose differently. That's the whole implicit message, even in the FDIC's categorization of people as banked, unbanked, underbanked. And by looking at the numbers, I couldn't really figure it out. I knew from working in poor communities for 20 years that low-income people know where their money goes, probably more than people who have more of a buffer. And I realized that if I wanted to really understand it, I had to get as close to the problem as possible. You know, when you're a researcher, you have to match the method to the question. And the only method I could really figure out was to get really close. And I knew that even just talking to people and interviewing them would not give me the full story. And it turned out to be right. Really, by working behind the window for months and looking at the way that people manage their money, I learned a ton.
These check cashers are often targets of journalists and academics.
Yeah.
As people who do, or organizations that do prey on sort of poor minority clients. Did you go into it with that expectation? Because that's the sort of the dominant narrative that's out there.
It's certainly what I thought before I began to look into it more deeply. So kind of a pivotal moment for me was having this man, Joe Coleman, who runs a chain of check cashers in the South Bronx and Harlem, come to a class I was teaching. And at the moment that he walked in the door, my students and I all thought exactly what you said. You know, these are bad guys. Now one of them's coming to our class. We get to really, like, ask him the tough questions. And Joe came in and he made a very compelling argument for why he felt like his businesses were serving people in those communities the way they needed to be served, and that banks were not doing that, and banks didn't really want their business. And so that kind of made me think, maybe there's more to the story. And so I tried to go in with a really open mind once I went to both of those businesses and worked at them.
And so you worked as a clerk?
Yep,
behind the
counter,
but you weren't undercover.
No, I wasn't undercover. That seemed like it would be unethical to try to pretend to be somebody I wasn't. So it made for a little bit of awkwardness in that the neighborhood I was working in the South Bronx is a primarily Latino neighborhood. I'm not a Latina. The women who I worked with were younger than me. Spanish is not my first language, although I speak it. But, you know, we overcame that pretty quickly. When you're standing behind a counter, you're working with people on a common project, people in line need something, and if you can provide it for them, it kind of works out.
What was the first thing that you discovered when you were working there?
I think the very first thing I discovered was how service-oriented the businesses were. After I did my stints as a teller, I came out from behind the counter and I did interviews with people. And the three things they told me that were the reasons why they chose the check cashier were cost, which was incredibly surprising, that it was cheaper than using a bank, transparency, They felt like they knew exactly what they were getting and how much they were paying, and service, which I already mentioned.
So basically, really old-fashioned values in
exactly.
a lot of ways.
Exactly. Yeah.
Take me through some of the people who go there, because some of them are really fascinating.
Yeah.
So, for instance, Carlos is one of the really fascinating
right.
characters in your book. Who is Carlos? Tell
so
me
Carlos
about
was a small business person. He's a small contractor. He does, carpentry and painting and sheetrocking and all that kind of stuff. He would come into the check casher regularly to cash a check that he got from a client. And, I saw him come and go, and then one day he brought in what I thought was a rather large check. It was about $5,000. He puts it under the window, under the slot, and I cashed it. And the fee for cashing that check, so they differ around the country from state to state, but in New York, the fee at that point was 1.95% of the face value of the check. So it was almost $200. And I'm kind of looking at that money, or looking at what I gave back to Carlos and saying, like, that's real money, right? Like, he could, he could save for his kids' education. He could take his wife out to dinner. He could put it in a retirement account. All of the kinds of things that people are saying when they're saying check cashers are expensive. So Carlos leaves, and I ask the teller who trained me, and this was really one of the benefits of not being undercover. I'm saying, like, why is he doing that? He's got to have a bank account. And she said, well, it's Thursday, so probably he's paying his guys tomorrow. And if you're in any city, and probably not just cities, a lot of workers are maybe undocumented or don't have a bank account. And so you'll see these contractors going around and paying them in cash. Well, if Carlos deposited that check on Thursday in his bank, he wouldn't have the cash until Tuesday or Wednesday. And that time lapse, the banks are getting what's called the float. It's huge for people that are living very close to the edge. So he needed his money right away, and he was willing to pay for it. Another reason why he may have done that is that he got a job where he needed paint, supplies, materials to start, so that if he couldn't have started the next day, he wouldn't have gotten the work. So again, he's paying for access to his own money right away.
You do address this idea that people take out loans and it becomes sort of addictive. They take out loans, they need to take out another loan to pay back the previous loan, and they get sort of stuck in this sort of endless cycle. And
right.
that's sort of a reason that people have said no to close down a lot of these banks.
The payday lenders.
A lot of these payday lenders.
Right. Payday loans, in case people don't know what they are, they're small short-term loans ranging from, say, $50 to $300 usually, that carry fees. Mm-hmm. So the place that I worked, Check Center in Oakland, California, you'd have to pay $15 per $100 borrowed. That adds up to a pretty hefty amount of money, right? The way they're designed, the reason they're called payday loans is that they're due on the next day that the person gets a check, whether it's their paycheck or a government check, and that's usually we're paid either bi-monthly or monthly. What happens is that a lot of the time, the reason somebody comes and gets that loan is that they've had an expense that they didn't expect, maybe a medical bill, a car repair. They need the money right away to deal with the problem, and sometimes the consequences are dire, right? If I don't fix my car, then I can't get to work and I'll lose my job. The problem becomes when it's 2 weeks later and you haven't had an income bonus, you haven't had to pay for that loan. And so what happens is that people roll it over and they continue to borrow that $100, but they pay another $15 fee. And so if people continue to do that, then they're paying much more than they originally borrowed. And that's where people get troubled.
And critics of this exact scenario, they look at this and they say, this is why payday lenders need to be either regulated or shut down entirely. And they're banned in, what, several states?
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Six states, seven states?
13 states.
13 states. Mm-hmm. But you have a very different take on it. And I think very rightly you say that that shutting down payday lenders like that doesn't eliminate the underlying problem, which is the need, the basic need and the basic demand for these services.
That's right. I think if you got rid of every payday lender on the planet, you'd still have this need, right? And people needing to get the money.
So clearly, I mean, some of this spills over from financial issues into just basic poverty issues.
Exactly, right? Yeah. Exactly. And if we're not paying attention to that problem also,
right.
No matter what we do in the financial services industry, and we need to do a lot, don't get me wrong, but it's not going to solve that problem.
You paint a very sort of darkly pessimistic view of the American economy, frankly, in the beginning. And it makes sense given some of the locations you were working in. But you switch very quickly to the innovators section, to what seems like a very rosy picture for the future, which is based in apps and technology and people really trying to shake up the way the whole network of finance works in a very deep way. Can you talk about that and how that sort of gives us a much better outlook for the situation?
For sure, yeah. The good news is that two things. One is that we don't have to just look to banks for solutions to the financial services problem. I don't think we should let banks off the hook, but we don't have to look only to them. And so we have two kinds of people in the innovative space. One are people who I think are doing really interesting work on the infrastructure of banking. So two that I really think are doing terrific work. One is called Ripple in San Francisco. And Ripple is creating what it calls an internet of value, making it easy to move your money without cost and immediately, the same way that we move information using email on the internet. And so what that would do is that when Carlos goes to the bank and puts his check in, the money would be available to him immediately. If somebody is sending money to their relatives in Mexico or Guatemala, instead of having it stop five times between Western Union and the bank in Mexico City, it would move immediately and free and cheaply, without cost.
At rock bottom, though, I think what these apps do, and I think what you mentioned later on in your book, is ultimately about the question of, do we trust individuals to make decisions with their own finance, even if they're poor, even if they're in desperate circumstances? And I think you talk about that. You talk about a little bit about that ultimately we have to respect people's judgment and without judging them and without judging their choices.
I think there's a lot of judgment in even, you know, I mentioned before this way that we think about people now is in terms of whether they're banked, unbanked, or underbanked, right? And I think that that was a useful framework for talking about people for a long time. But there's a sort of an edge of being derogatory in that, and kind of if you're unbanked, then there's something wrong with you. It assumes that banking is the one and the best and only way to manage your finances, and that people who don't do that are somehow deficient in some way. So we need to unpack this whole category of subprime people or unbanked people and look at the specific populations within those larger categories.
So the old idea of the rite of passage of your first bank account at Pulaski Bank, is that dead? Is that something of the past?
My kids don't have bank accounts at Pulaski. I recently opened them bank accounts at the bank I go to now. But I think it's a little bit different now. We have to teach them the habits of spending and saving and being able to give money away if they're fortunate enough to have more money than they need to do some charity work. I think it's a very different world now.
That was a hallmark of middle class life, right?
That's right.
You've got a bank account. Welcome to
that's
America.
Right. The American that's right. Game. That's right. I know people who still have those passbooks that they saved from when they were kids.
Yeah, no, I remember. And I remember not being able to get money out of the bank after 3 p.m.
That's right. Yeah, and we organized our lives that way.
Yeah.
It's not that way anymore.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
For Reason TV, I'm Todd Cranin.